But part of it, we've been interviewing people for the last 20 years. I think we started with Ivan and Orpha.
Uh-huh.
And we got about 40, I don't know, between 40 and 50. I never thought I'd be interviewing my generation, but here we are. So, what's the first thing you remember, your earliest memory?
Of Mount Pleasant?
Of anything. When you were a little type.
I guess my mother's death.
The train ride to Cincinnati.
Yeah, the train ride to Cincinnati to see my mother. My mother died of cancer when she was 32 years old.
How old were you?
I was probably five at that time.
Six.
Well, when Mom died, I was six. So I went to... My dad took us... She went to Cincinnati, Ohio, for treatment for cancer. Well, she didn't really know she had cancer. First of all, she went to a chiropractor. She had breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And in today's society, she would have never died. And so anyhow, that was really my first... And I don't really remember Mom at all.
Really?
No. I remember the funeral a little bit, you know. I wondered why everybody was crying in the funeral. What was all the deal, you know? And we were in the Amish church. Not the real old order Amish. We were called the King Church. And that's where I went to Sunday school and learned my ABCs, the ABCs, and things like that, you know, the real German stuff, you know.
Well, did you learn Pennsylvania Dutch first or English first?
Pennsylvania Dutch was the very first, yeah. That's all I ever knew. When I went to school, they had a hard time with me the first year because I tried to teach me English, you know. And it was all Pennsylvania Dutch. So I went to a Christian day school for the first grade and the second grade, then I failed the first grade because I couldn't speak English right and stuff. And then Dad bought a farm in this little town called Middle Branch in around Canton, Ohio.
Sheppy.
And that's when I transferred to public school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to public school then the rest of my life, you know.
But the public schools there are partly controlled by the Amish, aren't they? Or aren't they on the school board?
They're much different than down here. They got a good school system up there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're controlled by the Amish, or even the Amish are on the school board. But an interesting fact is that now his nephew's wife teaches in Berlin, Ohio, in a public school that is almost entirely Amish children.
Mm.
And so when COVID happened, nobody had computers. She did lesson plans, and the parents came and picked up the lesson plans and took them home a week at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to insert here another very interesting fact, and you will like this, and that is that Amanda Beiler was a close friend of his mother.
Oh, really?
And they both had breast cancer at the same time, and it was considered not a good thing to do, to have your breasts removed, but Amanda had her breasts removed, and look how long she lived.
Yeah.
Is that just amazing?
Huh.
Well, is Amanda from that area?
She was.
Yeah.
She must have moved down here fairly young then, because I've seen her in pictures that when my mother was a teenager, and she's there with all the other young folks. A little older, but still in the
Yeah.
It is interesting.
So anyhow, that's... we've had a... in my childhood was dad always had a hard time financially, just surviving. And then we had
Was he a farmer?
Yeah, we were a farm. But he always wanted to work outside of the farm one day a week or so. He worked at this flea market for years and years. And he loved that job. I don't know, he didn't do it for money so much. He got paid. Mm-hmm. He was a very good friend of his. Hard Miller is the guy he worked for, and he's a big shot in the Hartville area where we were, mm-hmm. where they stayed at the last in Hartville. But I was born in Hartville, Ohio. And then we moved to Miller Branch, and that's when I went to public schools and did all that stuff.
Did your dad remarry?
Yeah, my dad found this Mennonite girl. It was a big change of our life right there. He married Amy. She was working downtown cleaning houses, working for the rich people down there. And her daddy was a preacher in Indiana, Elkhart, Indiana. And she had some money, and she owned a couple of houses, and she gave everything to Dad to start all over again in a farm in Miller Branch, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And that's how Dad got another start.
Because the first farm burned down. Mm. The barn burned.
So we got going, and lo and behold, she slips and falls, going down to the chicken house, and breaks her hip, a leg, and I don't know, several different places, wasn't it?
Knee,
something. But anyhow, I remember going to the hospital to see her, and had this big pin go through her leg. Mm. She lay there for a month or more. Then she froze up, her leg froze up. And so she was stiff from then on. Mm. And I remember my sister Esther, she took care of Amy, and by the way, then Amy and Dad had another son together, Donnie.
Okay.
And Donnie just passed away. Passed away. And so that's how that situation ended up. And her health was just not good at all. And Dad just constantly had to take care of her and everything. But she really brought a lot to us, but that's when we switched to Mennonites.
Became okay, I didn't realize that you had.
Yeah.
He was nine.
Okay.
For several years, the children lived with the relatives and came home on the weekends. And then one day, Esther, by then she was 13, she said, enough. They all got together and said, she dropped out of school and took care of him for probably a year until Dad married Amy. Mm. But Merv was nine when Dad married Amy.
Okay. So then, which Mennonite church did they go to then?
The Hartville Conservative Mennonite Church.
Okay.
We called it Frank Dutcher's Church.
But The Roman Miller Church, the Frank Dutcher Church, so many splits and little churches up there. Oh, they've got Mennonite churches all over the place, And so we always, Dad always stayed with Frank Dutcher's church because his boss, Howard Miller, stayed at that church. Mm-hmm. Howard was the king of Hartville, the area. He still is. His family still is. But so that's how we got going. But when we, then we got a car. That was a big thing for me and my brother. We'd shine that car, man, and carry on. And we got to be high cotton, But all our relatives, Dad's sister Kate and them, they were Peachy Amish, but they had cars and stuff, and they all. They all were fairly well-to-do compared to us. We were always on the bottom of the pole. And then Grandpa had a stroke. Mom and Dad had a stroke, and he became paralyzed, wasn't he? Jonas?
Yeah, I don't know what all his... He required constant care. He was not bedridden, but... but up to a chair and back in the bed.
Well, as a kid, all I remember is that he was always in bed, always in bed. You know, we were never really that close to him. We were always close to Dad's side a little bit more. So, Dad's dad was very rich. He was the king of. He had the best farm, the best everything, and how many brothers and sisters did Dad have?
I want to say there were 12 of them, I think.
About 12, yeah.
None of his brothers and sisters still living. One of your mother's youngest sister is still living.
Yeah.
We have one aunt living.
Dorothy.
But a lot of the medical things that happened in his family would be curable today.
Yeah.
And it was just sad.
That was true. It strikes me in doing this research, how many people in our graveyard wouldn't have died if it had been today.
But yeah, you know, there wasn't such a thing as going to a doctor back in them days, you know.
What kind of farm did your dad have?
We milked cows.
How many?
About 25 cows.
By hand.
By hand. Dad never bought a milk or never.
Really?
Bought. We were just... We were always behind the block, you know. No modern equipment. Dad did everything the hard way. You know, that's how he was brought up with, from his dad. Yeah.
So when you were a teenager, what would your typical day be like? Like, you start out in the morning and then what?
We'd get up in the morning and go out and milk cows.
What time?
5 o'clock in the morning. To go out, milk cows, milk. I had milk about four cows. My brother milked about six, and Dad milked the rest. You know.
Did you milk into a bucket and then pour it into a 10-gallon can?
And then we had a milk cooler, and we put it in the milk cooler, which was cold water. And then the milkman would come by and pick it up. You know, every day he'd come by.
Did you have a little crane to put it in there, or you had to pick them in there by hand?
Put them in there by hand. Yeah.
Ooh.
And them things. I remember I could pick up two of them and put them in there at one time.
Really?
Yeah, good. How much does a milk can hold? I got one up there.
That's a 5 gallon, but you all use some 10-gallon milk cans.
Most of 5 gallons.
5 gallons, well that's so a 5 gallon.
5 gallons, I could pick two of them up one hand, both hands, yes. And I got a job being the milkman, going around picking up milk for a while. I didn't do it very long, but I did it for a while.
Did that when I was a kid, and we used to ride along.
Yeah.
Roll those cans from the back to the front. Yeah. About 6 years old, couldn't pick one up, of course, but roll it.
But anyhow, it was that was kind of my childhood. We lived on the farm. We always had plenty to eat, so on and so forth. But we were always a little bit, the poor people of the church, kind of, I would say, because I know that the Compassion Fund helped Dad a lot. You know, that's why I've always been gung-ho for our Compassion Fund a little bit. A lot of people helped Dad, but his dad, I remember when we needed a new cow, Dad would go in the barn of his dad's. And there was a milk can he had hid back there full of money. And Dad would go in there and get money out of there and put a note in it. And this is how much I took the way it went, you know. And that's how Dad would buy another cow and on and on. And then when inheritance came, Dad didn't get none. Everybody else got everything, you know. So. But then living down there, and I went to school, and I was never a great student in school, but I made many friends in school and stuff like that. And then I got in high school, then I became quite a star football player, you know. I was an old farm boy, just a lot tougher than all those other people.
What position did you play?
Running back. Always running back, and then on defense, I played defensive back, you know. And, but I got a lot of lot of, you know, trophies and a lot of headlines in the paper for me, for the thing that winning the scoring crown and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, none of researched all that stuff for me. Yeah.
A few years ago, let me back up and say that I made scrapbooks for all of my grandchildren. Uh-huh. From and went to their ancestry, did a family tree, and from the time of their parents' marriage and so on, all the way until they graduate from high school. Merv said, I sure wish somebody had done that for me. I said to myself, okay. And I did it. He didn't know it. I surprised him. And I did it in the attic, and I did it at my office, and, mm-hmm. and where he couldn't see it, never saw it. But I wrote, I thank goodness for the internet, and I knew, I had a picture from his high school football team, and I knew he was a star. And so I went online, and this had names, and so I started looking for the names, and I contacted one, and he contacted everybody else. They sent me newspaper clippings, they sent me his letter, you know, you get a letter, mm-hmm. like it's woolen or something, you know. Pictures, all kinds of stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah, at the same time, I wrote to his. He then had 5 living aunts mm-hmm. on his mother's side, and so I wrote to all of them and asked about his mother as a child, growing up, and so on. And they all wrote back to me, and I wrote to his cousins, his boy cousins, when he was growing up, and they all sent me stories. It was very fascinating.
So yeah.
But that's how we documented his he ran one time, he ran a 101 yard touchdown.
Yeah, 105 yards.
105 yards.
And that was big news.
Yeah. And then while I'm making this scrapbook, his brother Donnie sent because I asked each of his brothers and sisters for information and pictures as well. And Donnie sent me a clipping during that time. That was currently in the Canton repository 50 years ago today. You know, they always had, they do that, uh-huh. you know. 50 years ago today, Mervyn Troyer ran 105 yards for a touchdown. And so he sent me that clipping as well.
That was not long ago. That was a couple years ago.
Probably 10 now.
Then,
I mean, COVID was 5 years ago. You think about that.
Yeah.
You know, I base everything by before COVID. And you think, well, if it was before COVID, it was at least 5 years ago, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did you play other sports also, or just football?
Yeah, I played them all. But, you know, I played baseball, and I ran track. Track was probably my second best. And the track coach said, I mean, the football coach said, come on, cut all that stuff out. You need to pay attention to football. Because I was so fast. I could run so fast. And I held state records all over.
Really?
Yeah, the 100-yard dash and stuff like that. You know, and I did the hurdle jumpings and all those things. And I was very privileged to go to a really nice school, a high-class mm-hmm. school. We were one of the best schools in Canton. In fact, the Football Hall of Fame, that was our home field of the day. That's where, although they fixed it up really fancy from where I went mm-hmm. since I played on it. But that football field, they still play the Hall of Fame game there now. Yeah. Canton High was really known for football. Canton and this little town called Maslin, was really known for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, you know, that was basically, you know, once I got to school, that was pretty good. And Dad was always a little bit against me playing in sports, you know.
How come?
And he says, you need to stay home and work on the farm, boy. You know, we can't make no money, you playing football, you know. And so on and so forth. As far as having some scholarships or something like that, yeah, I had some small schools look at me a little bit, you know, but it was nowhere to go because Dad would put a foot to that, you know. Dad always still, you know, he was the Amish guy, you know. He felt like his dad, you know. So when I got to the 11th grade, the senior year, Dad made me quit school, and I never did graduate. And once I got through football, the coaches came out and talked to Dad. He says, "Come on, we need him to play this final year," and he finally let me do it. I know he used to brag about me behind my back, but never to me. He never came to see me play.
Really?
No, never. Anybody I ever played to see me was my brother, Clarence. Clarence supported me a lot. You know, he was always there for me, Clarence.
Well, did you stay on the farm until you were 21?
Mm-hmm. I stayed on the farm until I was 21. But Dad used to ship me out to work for other people and stuff like that, for a week or two here, and a month here, and a month there, but we still took care of the farm, you know. And then about 21 and a half, 22, was done when I had to go to 1W service.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a total change of life there, huge. So I go from the farm to Cleveland, Ohio.
How come you chose Cleveland? Or how come you chose that?
Close to home. Close to home. And I knew a bunch of my buddies from the church that went there, Paul Miller and little John Yoder. In fact, John became my best man in school, in my wedding. And when I went to 1W, me and Philip met up right away. Like, Philip's got the same idea as I got, you know. And so we played ball up there, and we did a lot of things up there.
Were you already there when Philip and Ed came up, or?
I went to 1W with Olin, Philip, and Eddie.
You all came about the same time?
Mm-hmm.
Did you start about that? They all lived in a big house together. Merv rented a big house.
Oh, okay.
And they all lived in this house. And they only had, I don't know how many bedrooms, but they somebody was always in the bed. Some worked nights, some worked days.
Yeah.
We lived in one room apartment in 117th Street in Cleveland.
That was the apartment.
And there was five of us, and one was one bed, and we all worked different shifts, and there was somebody in bed the whole time, all the time. Occasionally somebody would sleep on the couch, you know. And what a mess that was, you know. So that was kind of my first business venture. Like, I went out and found a house, and I says, all right. And I got these guys all to pay me so much, and everybody moved in my house, and that's where I started my little business thing. And I said, everybody go right there, and I don't have to pay no rent. And go that way. That was a nice home too, beautiful home. Can't believe that guy would let me have it. But we had a good time there. I mean, my folks even came up there. We made dinner for them up there, stuff like that. Dad came up. Yeah. Dad and Mom, Amy only came here twice?
I think twice.
Twice, something like that.
Yeah. So when was the first time you came to Virginia?
At Philip's wedding. I came down once before for something.
You just came down with them, with Philip and Wayne the summer before Philip's wedding, 61 years ago. And because we went out on a double date, he was with Donna and I was with Eddie.
Donna Miller,
yeah.
She gave me my first kiss.
See what?
That's how I got my first kiss from Donna.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't get a kiss from her.
Oh, geez.
Then he came back for Philip's wedding.
Right.
Yeah, and I told Wayne, I says, hey, is that Miller girl? Yeah. A pretty sharp girl. I'll check her out. So fix me up with a date with her if I come down there. And that's when she just broke up with Eddie. She dated Eddie Yoder. Mm-hmm. And she just broke up, and I caught her on the rebound, and that was it. We didn't date 3-4 times, maybe.
We went. No, Wayne wrote to me. I was in Colorado. In PS. Wayne wrote to me and said, I know you're coming home for Philip's wedding, and would you go out with this guy? And of course I knew him, but I knew who he was because, anyway, I said, sure. So we went to the rehearsal dinner together, and then I went to the wedding with my parents, and after I went to the reception with him. After the reception, I went home and packed my suitcase, and a carload of us went to Ohio. and so I changed my airline ticket from flying from Norfolk to flying from Cleveland, I guess, I went up there. It was Susan was with Owen Yoder, and Wayne had Jeanette Matthews,
yeah,
and me and Merv, the six of us in the car. And the guys, I don't know where the guys stayed. The girls stayed at their apartment. At this point, they were staying in an apartment, still in. I don't know.
We stayed
in an apartment that they vacated for us.
Right.
And then he took me down to visit his folks, and I went back to Colorado. And this ring came in the mail.
And that's how he proposed.
Yeah. I went back to Colorado to BS, and I said, I'm engaged, and they're like, ha! And then this ring came in the mail. And that was in July. He moved down here about September, maybe, and he lived with Philip and Martha. And then I came home in November. We got married in December.
What kind of work did you do when you first came down?
I was a warehouse man for Virginia Door Company. I went to Virginia Door was owned by Wayne Door Company in Mount Hope, Ohio. So I went to Mount Hope, Ohio. I says, look, I'm looking for a job in Virginia. You all have a branch in Virginia and Overhead Door Company. And this guy, Willis Willard, he just took over the company, huge company. Anyhow, so he hired me to go down there and work down there. And they let me be a warehouse man. And
that was over in Western Branch area?
That was over in Portsmouth. And
what road was it on? What road was the warehouse on?
Glasgow Street.
Glasgow Street.
So it was actually in Portsmouth before the...
Right downtown in Portsmouth. Bad part I had, I didn't know the roads, I didn't know how to get to work, Nana had to help me with finding how to get around. We didn't have GPSs and all that stuff, you know. That was tough. But anyhow, it didn't last long. I was a warehouse guy that I moved into stalling doors. I said, those guys were making all kinds of money installing doors. I said, I like to stall doors. And so they moved me in there, and I became a door installer for a couple of years, I think, And then all of a sudden, the company was having financial problems with the door. And so Willis Mullet, the new guy that took over, he was the son, he took over Wendor. And he came down here, and somehow he just liked me for some reason, I don't know. Me and Ken Miller. And he...
Was Ken Miller working there then, too?
Yeah.
Was there any other Mennonites working there?
Oh, yeah. Sally Byler was working there. Cletus Hobbs was working there. Vernon Miller was working there.
Oh, really?
It was almost all Mennonites. Cletus taught me how to hang doors. Cletus Hobbs did that. Oh, what a mess he was. And him and Vernon and me taught me how to hang doors. And I just grew in the company really quick. And Willis came from Ohio, mm-hmm. came down here and says, look, I'd like for you to take over the company. And if you'd be interested, take over the company on a consignment basis. I'll send you the doors, you send me a check. When you sell one, you send me the check. You know, and whatever profit you make is yours, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had everything from Peninsula this side all the way down to North Carolina. And Ken had everything from Newport News on, Ken Miller. Mm-hmm. And that lasted for about 3 years, maybe. Something happened with, they got, with Ken, he didn't pay his bills fast enough or something, and they took that franchise away and gave me that franchise too. So now, me and Philip's father, Vernon, we had the whole division.
You all were partners in it?
That, yeah, me and Philip's father. So then, I said to Philip and my team, my best buddy, I said, Philip, you need to quit, before you're going to telephone company. Mm-hmm. So you need to come to work for us. We can make a whole lot more money. You can make it, what you're doing. So Philip joined me in the door business, and it just grew and grew and grew, and we did almost 80% of all the doors in the area, almost. And then finally,
Did y'all build a warehouse on Portsmouth Boulevard?
We left there then and moved to the chicken houses. I says, I ain't gonna pay that rent over there.
Okay.
So Glasgow Street to Portsmouth Boulevard.
Okay, and then to the chicken house.
We never owned Portsmouth Boulevard. We didn't own the company.
Okay.
Once they got the doors on consignment, he and Vernon, they went to the chicken houses.
Okay.
I mean, why would you pay rent to them when you could
have an
empty chicken house that you could make into a warehouse?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember cleaning them chicken houses up and getting it all ready for over there. Martha would complain about all the dust and dirt we made. I said, Martha, we're making money too. But yeah, that's how I started in business. And then one day, I saw this ad about a golf course, Stumpy Lake Golf Course.
They had bought Vernon out. Philip came and worked as an installer for a little while, and then Merv and Philip bought Vernon out. They paid him whatever his share was worth, and he continued to work for them.
Yeah.
But then Merv and Philip owned the business.
Okay. So back up on the golf. When did you start playing golf?
When I was about 22, 23 years old.
Was that in Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
Was that from Olin? Was Olin the first of you to play golf?
The first foursome that we had was Olin, Morris, Philip, and me.
Morris was never in Ohio.
No, I played some in Ohio, and they come down here and I told the guys, let's start playing golf a little bit. So we got into golf a little bit.
All right. See, I interviewed Olin about, I don't know, 2-3 months before he died.
Uh-huh.
And he said that he was the first one to play golf. Somebody invited him out, and he liked it so much, he came back and told the rest of them, we got to try golf. Is that how you remember?
It is a little bit that way, yeah.
And, that was in Ohio, or it was down
in Ohio? In Ohio.
It was in Ohio. Tennis.
Yeah. We didn't play much in Ohio. Most what we played in Ohio was basketball and softball.
Right.
Yeah, that's what we did. And Olin didn't play much softball with us. But Olin was a decent golfer. So when we came down here then, it was Olin and Philip being. And we'd go out there and play and play and play, and it was me and Philip against Olin and Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And long story being short, Morris got too good for us. He kicked all of our butt, man. He didn't take long, he was shooting even far, man. He was good, Morris. Then we went and played most softball. You should probably remember mm-hmm. our softball teams,
yeah.
Virginia Dover softball teams. So anyhow, then we grew in the business. Then after a while, I just felt like Philip, man, all he wanted to do was go fishing. And I started having to fall out with Philip a little bit. And I wanted to keep growing in the business. He didn't want to grow in the business. And we split up. How many years did we split up?
Well, let's go back and say 1968 is when he first became an owner of Virginia Door. 1968. In 1977, they got their first lease at Stumpy Lake, and Philip and Merv were still in it together.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't tell you for sure. I think it was about 1979 when Merv took the, well, don't put that in the book, but as you're aware, there were some drug problems in between there. And Merv ended up with the golf and Phil ended up with the door company. But there was some unpleasantries in between. We won't even go there.
No, no need to.
Yeah.
Because before he died, Phil came up to him one after, when Phil and Martha started coming back to our church, it was so heartwarming. He came up to Merv and clapped him on the back. I don't know what he said, something about, I want the past forgotten. I want us to be friends. It was wonderful.
Yeah, Phil and me patched up really good.
Okay.
With everything, and Philip was just a little bit more laid back than I was, you know. I was the aggressor of everything.
And you know, he worked for my dad as a helper when he was in high school. And Daddy used to say Philip was the best helper I ever had until a gun went off.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Philip taught me in the buying a boat. We bought a boat, and I'd see that boat pull up to the gas pumps, and he'd fill, you know, that thing took hundreds of gallons of gas. And then he'd take a couple of my installers, and I said, man, this ain't right, Philip. Man, we got all this work, and you're out there fishing. But anyhow, that's how it all started. But then I just become very aggressive in the golf business. Mm-hmm. How did the story go? But when I sold Virginia Door back to Philip then, and I sold the door back to Philip, and I built that big warehouse out in Greenbrier. Mm-hmm. That was a big move. That was back in the Carter days. We built, that building's there yet. In fact, I forget who the builder was anymore. Anyhow, I know I ended up finishing the building myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wasn't it AC Miles?
I think it was AC.
So.
He built those kind of buildings then, about
yeah.
that time.
Yeah. It was a big metal building. And finally, then when I sold the door company to Philip, I said, you got to keep renting my building. You know, so he stayed in, that was in Greenbrier, right there by Cavalier Ford, mm-hmm. not far from it.
I remember where it was.
Yeah. And that was, you know, that $700,000-$800,000 building, something like that, you know. So I got a start there, and then it kept going into golf. And then Philip left as soon as his 5 years was up. He left, and he went and built that one's out there now on Mount Pleasant Road, that big building.
Mm-hmm.
And that's identical to the building. I
oh, really?
Yeah, almost identical. Yeah, yeah. And this electric company rented it for me. And they rented it for, I don't know how many years. Then all of a sudden, one day we get a check for the whole thing. The guy paid it off. And I was trying to avoid taxes, you know. And we ended up getting the whole check at one time.
I think it was a rent to own or something.
Ah, okay.
I don't remember.
So how many golf courses did you eventually...
Seven.
Running.
Seven, yeah.
It was, I know Stumpy Lake was the first one, and you still got that one?
Uh-huh, I'm still there.
Okay.
Still there, with a 5-year lease. and then we got one 20-year lease with the City of Virginia Beach. But we started off with Stumpy Lake, and then I became very good friends with Dr. Montero over here. And me and Montero, he got me into the banking business. And I would always say to the bank, I said, look, I don't want to keep renting golf courses. I want to buy golf courses. And I said, whenever you have one, let me know. And Bob asked him, he's the big guy with Tom Bank. He said, I'll make sure you'll get one. And sure enough, about a year later or more, Cypress Point Country Club came along. That was a big deal, you know. I think we paid about $4.5 million for that, something like that.
This little Amish farm boy buying it.
Yeah, Amish boy. That was a big deal. And we had enough money at that time, we could have retired at that time. And we discussed it a little bit. And Olin came to me and said, Olin says, Merv, no, you can't retire. You're too good at making money, man. Don't do this. I says, you need to keep on going. And a little bit of encouragement there, a little bit of courage here, and it kept me going. And then we bought that, and then now I'm debt up the yin yang. And it took us, 25 years to pay for that golf course. And then another thing happened. The city of Norfolk came to me, Mr. Troyer, we need you to help us run some of our golf courses. And so that's when I got into Lake Wright Golf Course. Mm-hmm. Lake Wright Golf Course. And then I got up. Then they said, we're going to build a golf course. We need you to help us build this golf course. And then we built Lambert's Point right by Old Dominion.
Oh, yeah. I played that one.
We played that, yeah. And that was a brand new golf course.
Those Lowell were, Wanger of all people.
Yeah. Who?
Lowell Wanger.
Lowell!
Yeah, that was the start. I got into construction of the golf courses and stuff like that. And I had this wonderful guy with me called Mike Fentress working for me. He was my manager. And he worked for 18 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And he helped me put all the stuff together. And we really had some good contracts with Norfolk. There were management contracts. Mm-hmm. You know, I got paid whether we made money or not, you know. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they didn't make no money at Lambert Point. But at Lake Wright, we made a lot of money for the city and Norfolk. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into that. And then all of a sudden, now I'm on the board with Tom Bank, and I'm meeting all kinds of big guys, you know. And this guy, Tom Balls, he's one of the big guys at City of New Beach. And, he had a focus of money, and he taught me in the Vine Honeybee golf course and Chesapeake golf course at one time. In fact, I did that without talking to Nana.
I was out of the country when he bought those golf courses.
Yeah.
But anyhow, it all worked out.
Never forget, there was $7.5 million. I was man. But Tom became such a pain in the neck. I couldn't stand working with him. And finally, I bought him out, and I just stayed with Baba. Just not me, and it's been that way ever since. So that's my business venture. And
we had Owl's Creek too, somewhere in there.
And we bought this course called Owl's Creek
when we were with Tom Royce.
Right on the
2001.
Right on the ocean front.
Swampy Lake, 1977. Cypress Point, 1992, Lake Wright, 1996, Chesapeake and Honeybee, 2001, Owls Creek, 2002, and Lambert's Point, 2004, in that order. Mm-hmm.
So then...
Then God gradually took them away from us, thankfully. Like, Lake Wright closed because they made a golf shopping center there. Lambert's Point closed.
I didn't know that.
Owls Creek closed.
I sold Owls Creek, yeah.
And then we sold Cypress Point and sold Chesapeake and Honeybee just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm.
That's what really helped us was the virus came in and people didn't have nothing to do but play golf. Mm-hmm. You can sit in your house all day. They would just come out there and grows. And we made a fortune in about 3 years, you know. And so our numbers just got way up. And then the guys from Ohio came out there and said, we'd like to buy your golf. Well, you're making all kinds of money. So
that's the time to sell.
And that's when we sold. We sold. In fact,
they're not doing very well.
They're not doing so good.
But that's their problem.
It just goes to show you, without good management, what happens, you know. Mm-hmm. And this guy's got lots of money, but they don't know how to run a golf course. But in the meantime, we basically still own Chesapeake, because I ain't been paid for that yet. So mm-hmm. They owe us for that one yet. But they make it monthly payments. So I don't know how long it's going to last. I might get it back. And I hope I get it back before I die so I can do what I have to do with it to get it back in shape so Donna don't have to do it now.
You know, you had mentioned earlier that there were a lot of Mennonite churches in Ohio because they kept splitting off from one another. And every church does that. I mean, there's not, because I've read any book I can lay my hands on about other Mennonite churches who have a history or the conference histories and so forth, and they all go through splits. And I've talked to Dale a lot about this because it was intriguing. You know, the whys and the wherefores, because they always seem to couch it first in a difference in theological belief, but in reality it's a difference in personalities, or somebody made somebody mad, or you've got two different people who want power and so they can't share it, so they split. And one of the things, like, there was a split here in 19, at the Mount Pleasant Church in 1910, almost immediately after the church was built. But nobody knows about it, and I didn't know about it either, and only knew about it because I kept reading about, I started adding up the people who left, and then started seeing in letters comments that were not specific to it, but like it was a letter that Clarence Miller wrote to Dwight. Clarence was 13 at the time. Said something about A. Landis and Wirt's farms are for sale, you ought to come home and buy them, because he was in Goshen at the time. And he said, I guess the whole tribe will leave. Well, the whole tribe, that means there's something different than the inn people. And so there were, that they all seemed to be from Juniata County originally, and were here, and several months after the church was finished and they started doing it, they started meeting in Landis's home, which was where Carson Hostetler's was, the deal store place. And then all left. You know, but nobody ever wrote exactly what it was about. I think it was probably dress and the fact that A.D. Wanger had just moved in here, and T.J. Wanger, who was a deacon, and you had Brunk over on the other side, who was bishop after Wirt was kicked out, and he was a Wanger, he was married to a Wanger sister. So you had this Wanger triumvirate, and they were all very conservative. I mean, the Virginia Conference was at that time really pushing on dress. In fact, I found a letter that Brunk had written to A.D. Wanger about 1913 or so. He said, about so-and-so, E.B. is over here, Grace E.B. is over here. And she was wearing the most heathen Babylonish collar. You should address that. We have our own E.B. problems. We're handling them. You know, So I suspect that's what it was. And one of the things I want to cover in this history, because at least in some depth, is the situation with Sam. What is your perspective on that? What happened?
With Sam?
What happened? What is your thought?
I thought Sam became dishonest, especially with Nina. And he, I know that I spoke up. I don't speak up much. But this couple that worked for me, what was her name? They came to our church, and that's how we got the blue book, hymnal now. She wanted that blue hymnal.
Yeah, it was Jill Freeze's sister, Cheryl.
Cheryl, yeah.
Cheryl.
Sam,
lived over on West Road.
What?
Lived over on West Road.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. I know you're talking about.
Sam treated them so bad, and she got so upset with Sam.
How so? I mean, what? How do you mean he treated them bad?
By lying to them and this and that, and she just got, and I stuck up for her all that. And I said, how can a preacher do this to her? We're losing people then, and everything was starting to fall apart. But the big thing is I was upset the way he treated Nina. Sam didn't treat Nina right.
Sam, I don't know. Sam, people started coming to me. I forget I don't even know what it was that he didn't treat me right about. I have no idea. I couldn't tell you. I have no idea. Actually, Sam was here yesterday soliciting money for Lasia school, anyway. And we have a good, even after this all blew over, he and I met for breakfast one morning and said, I'm sorry, and we want, you know, let's go on. we don't have to agree, but let's go on. And so he and I have made our amends a long time ago. But anyway, people start, I don't know what happened with me and Sam. I can't tell you, but I can say that people started coming to me and telling me their stories. Marilyn Byler, whatever her name was, yeah. Katie's wife.
Oh, Hicks.
Hicks. Came and said that Sam threw a chair at her. And Regina Miller came to me with a story about, I said I would never tell. So something that someone had done, some sexual advances someone had made to her, and she went to Sam about it, and he took the person's side against her. He didn't believe her. And I don't know if the word got out that people start coming and talking to me. I'm talking a dozen or more people came. And so I put out a request that if you, we're going to investigate him, and if you have, I don't know how I did that.
A request
somehow,
to who?
What?
To who? Who was the request to?
To everybody, anybody, and I don't know how I said to anybody, if you have anything, I wanted to write to the conference about him. And so I wanted anybody that has anything to contribute to this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote to the conference. People came and talked to me, and I wrote to the conference. I was really instrumental in getting Sam kicked out. Then, from the conference point of view, then we had a church meeting, which I also somehow called. I don't remember, you know, but we met.
Well, this was after they had the vote on whether to renew his contract, correct?
I don't know.
The
I
vote
just know
became
that
50-50.
We had a meeting where everybody could come and speak.
Right.
And he was there, and people let him have it with both barrels.
Yeah.
People, I'm talking maybe as many as 20 people.
I spoke.
Aired their grievances.
I even spoke that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Was there another meeting later then? Because I was at one meeting, but Sam wasn't there.
I didn't think Sam was there.
You don't think Sam was there?
Not when I spoke.
Okay,
well then maybe Sam wasn't there. I could be wrong. Anyway.
He was invited, but
chose not to come.
I've interviewed Sam on this whole subject too, so it's interesting getting the different perspectives and sides of the thing.
Sam was dishonest. He was selling
pyramids.
He was involved in a pyramid scheme. And
this has been going on not long ago.
And I think he's, I don't know.
I find out a lot because Eddie works for me. Eddie comes to me and says, that damn Sam, he just sold me this pyramid scheme.
You're talking about the Buffalo thing.
I don't know
what it is.
Yeah, shortly after Eric died, Sharon was working as secretary then. And she came to me because, and she did and does for financial advice and so forth, and said Sam had this thing that guaranteed 10% per month and thought it was a great idea for her to take Eric's insurance and put into it. And so I had spent about 3 days just investigating it and found out that it was, there's no way that foreign exchange does that, there's no way they can get paid that, this is a scam. Found out the guy was being investigated by Montana and the state of Virginia, and had also took Sam to lunch one day pretending I was interested in investing in it to get more on that side of it. And Montana called Virginia, Virginia called me and said we need to talk to Sam because he's selling unregistered securities. And at that point I called Sam and said, Sam, here's what's going on. I've done this, this, and this. You might want to get ahead of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last I ever heard of anything from Sam on it. And just told Sharon, don't do it. I know Ed told me later that he and somebody from Amelia had to go to Oregon or Montana, wherever, to testify when they charged the guy with fraud, but that essentially everybody lost their money, except Sam. That was the way they worked. They would do it with a preacher, make sure he got paid back, and then he would bring in the rest of them.
You never did get to talk to Philip?
I called to talk to Philip, and Martha answered it, and I just told her what I'd found out and left it there. I said, this is a scam. Here's what's it. If you have any more questions, you know, I'll be glad to show you anything I've got. I just wanted to warn you. I'd never heard
anything. But he lost his money.
And Philip lost a ton.
Really?
Yes.
It lost his. Everybody lost money except
but,
Sam.
Yeah. But Philip didn't hold it against Sam. I mean,
he
continued to support Sam. I mean, he left our church.
That's why
he Sam.
That's why Philip left. I couldn't believe he left. But it was his love for Sam.
Well, is it? I didn't perceive this, but when I interviewed Kenny Kurtz, he told me, and I hadn't even thought about it. He said more people left while Sam was here than left after he left.
Right, there were people, and that was the thing. That's when I got involved, and people were just quietly leaving, and just quietly leaving. And I started calling those people and saying, then I got on the ball and got a campaign going, really. When I think back on it, it was mean, but maybe it was necessary. I had a campaign going where I called people and said, why did you leave? Will you tell me why you left? And that's what, then I wrote to the conference and said, they left because of this, they left because of that, they left because of that, all of them left because of Sam. And we need to do something. I don't know. I try not to think about it.
I mean, I'm good friends with Sam, and I think he's got a gift.
Yeah, I do, but I wouldn't trust him as far as I could, out of my sight.
Yeah.
So he's soliciting. Yesterday he comes here and he's soliciting money for Lasia Academy. Mm-hmm. And we had already, I guess he was a little embarrassed, we had already made a pledge, but he didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so I said that, so he, okay, well, all right, well then just pay your pledge or whatever. And I said, well, you know, they said, I contacted them recently and asked them, when are we supposed to pay this? And they said, well, when we get enough pledges for $2 million, then we're going to go forward with it. But just hold off. And then I talked to Clementina when she was here, and she said, I asked her, you have your 2 million pledges. And she said, we're contacting our big donors now. So then Sam sits here and says that four big donors each pledged $500,000. So we have it, he said, we have the 2 million. So I wrote to Clementina this morning and I said, Sam said that you have that and that's wonderful, that's awesome. Just let me know when we should pay our pledge. I'm waiting to hear whether she says they have it.
Yeah.
I bet they don't. I'm betting it was a lie.
Man, this is a $5 million project. $5 million project.
I don't trust him.
No.
I don't hate him, but I don't trust him.
I never got involved with his finances. He tried to get me many, many times, and now I was backed away from him. I would have a theory: if it's too good to be true, it's not true.
It is.
Yeah, that's always the way I felt. I have a first cousin up in Ohio that lost everything. In one of them things.
Really?
Kurt Koblenz and my sister's son. And he took everybody down with him, his brothers, you know, everybody in the area. And his home was paid for. They lost his home, he lost everything. Mm. He's a big plumbing contractor. And he's making a comeback now. But Kurt tried to get me in more than one time. I just, it's too good to be true, Kurt. You know, come on, it don't make sense. Buying real estate in Florida, you know. Those people went to jail. You know.
I was really surprised Ed got involved in it because as tight as he is,
I know,
and close with the dollar.
Sam is smooth.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of...
He's talked to me, Ed has talked to me several times about...
You have to be to do it. To do a pyramid scheme, you have to be smooth.
Yeah, it tickles me. He comes and talks. Now, you know, this isn't everybody's business. And I know you won't tell anybody. Say, come on, Ed, we're all friends.
They had a terrible time with the inheritance thing, you know. And Ed is telling me, he says, man, all he wants is, he wants to settle right away, and it's going to take a while to get this thing, and Sam wanted his money right now. he says, good old Sam, but then there's good things about Sam.
Well, I think Sam has got some good qualities. I think one of the biggest problems was he has almost no empathy with people. He seems to have a tin ear that things don't make an impression on him that he can perceive how somebody else is reacting to or feeling about something he's saying or doing. It just seems to roll off of him.
Yeah.
He preaches like everything.
Yeah,
but, great preacher,
but
man. This is
he
preacher.
Wasn't a good pastor.
Well, he came from that outfit in Harrisonburg, who's, I forget their name now.
I remember he was in church in Harrisonburg.
Yeah, and they kind of left the Mennonites. I mean, they're still nominally Mennonite, but they've got their own conference.
Yeah.
But the guy that ran that was a control freak. And in fact, he would bring on young pastors like Sam, and as soon as they got to a position where they might be confronting him or in competition, he'd fire them. And there was even a group of them that would get together, they called themselves the, I forget what it was, but the resigned or the pre-resigned preachers of whatever this outfit was. And so he had that kind of training in the ministry anyway, where the minister says what happens, period. That's what goes, nothing else. And so when you get to a congregation like Mount Pleasant, where the congregation is used to making decisions, having somebody up above try to make decisions for you doesn't work so well.
Right.
And the same thing at Lansdowne when it was over there.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed Dave Zook to get his perspective on.
Oh, yeah, okay. I like Dave.
He's pretty level-headed.
Yeah, level-headed guy. You know, back to my family, all four of us, my brother, other than my half-brother Donnie, we all became millionaires, all four of us, without any education, anything. My sister Ruth is married to a preacher up here in New York. And in fact, he's in our conference. Him and Dale are good buddies.
Mm.
And my brother, he always did, he was a construction guy. But my brother Donnie, now, he's the highest educated of all of us. He went through high school, through everything. You know, he was a good student, but he was a pot smoker, and he never...
He could never get beyond the warehouse at Hoover. He worked for Hoover all his life. He worked for Hoover.
Hoover sweeper.
And he drove a forklift, but he could never get up because he couldn't pass the drug test.
Yeah.
He never married because the moon was more important to him than a woman.
They moved me out to the loading dock where I could smoke all I wanted to smoke.
But he was happy. He was content.
Yeah.
He was like my sister Velma, you know.
Uh-huh.
She's so pitiful, but she's so content.
He was smarter than her.
Well, now you say that, and sometimes you say to me that Velma's smarter than me.
Yeah, she's pretty sick, too.
Today is Rodney's birthday. He's 32.
Heaven sakes, that doesn't seem possible.
Yeah.
So where do you think the church is now and what the future is? Is it a good place, bad place, etc.?
Good place. Good place. I think the church is really good. That school really makes us tick. Financially, the church is in great shape. Last Sunday was amazing how many people was there.
It was good.
It was really amazing. And I see a lot of young kids, you know, especially with all the kefirs running around there, you know. I think good things for our church, yeah. I really like Nevin, and I like Keith too. We were kind of lucky to get Keith back in the church again. You know, that was a big one there, I thought.
Yeah, I thought so too. I was surprised. I wasn't surprised either, because In fact, I've interviewed him and gotten his... I think you're the last people I have to talk to now.
Oh, yeah.
At least on the Sam thing.
I think you've been all the way through. You talked to a lot of people, huh?
About 50 altogether. So
wow. Yeah. Wow. But well, I can read it all in this book.
Well, none of that's in the book. That's just my stuff. You're in there, though, says Nina. Yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
Okay. Check this thing.
This is your family story?
Yeah.
Yeah, we really had a good time with your brother in the last cruise that we ate dinner together every night, mm-hmm. together, you know, stuff like that. Especially Don and Dale, they know everything. Yeah.
What would you improve about the church if you could? Anything?
What would I improve? Yeah. I wish they would remodel the church. I gave them a lot of money for the building expansion. A big, big chunk of money I gave.
And then what kind of remodel?
They put it in the bank. They were talking about when we lost Kathy and...
Neil Townsend was turning the sanctuary around.
I'm so hard of hearing. Of course, I shouldn't move up front probably. To be able to hear better. But they're talking about, Neil said, we can never get a good sound system in there because it's a tunnel. It's a tunnel-like thing. So they go do the thing around. I said, we need X amount of dollars before we can do that. So I gave them the X amount of dollars. The money's there.
$50,000.
Well, then, you will be happy to know that. One, Neil is wrong about the sound system. That's not the reason to do it. But the admin committee has appointed a committee of all young folks and given them until August to come up with a plan to get it done.
To get it done. Turning
it around.
Right. Good. Good.
So, and I think what's Lynn's youngest boy's name?
Ricky.
Is in charge of it.
And he'll get something done.
And they're all in that generation.
Good. Okay. That's what's so... Let me just start by saying, Merv used to sit in church and complain, children are rattling the paper, you know, it's noise. Now we're just so happy to hear all the children in the church and the young people in the church.
Yeah.
The church has life again. Mm-hmm. I thought we were going the way of Deep Creek. You know, we never got that bad, but you know, we were dwindling. We were, anyway, but we have life again in the church.
Not only life, but there's a lot deeper spirituality there than than has been the case a lot of times in the past.
Right. They may wear shorts, they may wear clothes with holes in them and all of that stuff, but they're much more spiritual than we were when we were making sure that our sleeve was long enough and our dress was long enough.
Yeah.
Brother Phil always complained about that. Wasn't Phil one of the first ones to wear a sport coat?
Who wore a tie.
Yeah, he was much more evangelical than his predecessors were.
Yeah. He and my dad really butted heads over things like that. Musical instruments in the church. The first time Brother Phil played the guitar in church, my dad's parents left.
Did they really?
They did. They walked right on out.
Have you ever walked out of church over something?
No. I walked out of church one time because I had two little girls, and I don't know why. I think he was working nights or something. Anyway, he didn't. I guess it was a Good Friday service. It was in the evening, and they were I went because it was going to be communion,
mm-hmm.
and my little girls were so fussy, and I finally left and didn't take communion. It's one of those things you just sticks in your mind. That's the only time I know that I ever left.
Oh, you had mentioned sitting through a not pulling the money out of the hat, but a lot. And I think I figured that must have been when the lot was for Amos Wanger or Eli Kramer to be bishop, because that was about 1955, 56. And I can't find any other lot drawn since then.
You sure there wasn't a lot when they chose someone for Deep Creek to be the pastor at Deep Creek? Because this lot, if I recall correctly, James Berge was in the lot that I was talking about.
I'll have to look further. I have not seen anything for that yet, but it could have been.
It seemed to me that it was... I know that James Berge was in the lot because Mary was very hurt. He wasn't chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And later he was chosen. So I think this might have been a lot for a deacon and not for a pastor.
Could be.
I think.
Because the pastors... let's see. Levi Kramer wasn't by a lot. Clayton Berge wasn't by a lot. Phil Miller wasn't by a lot. Amos Wenger was by a lot. But that was in the...
I wouldn't remember that. Yeah.
And none since then were...
I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Anyway.
I just remember sitting there, you know, and then one by one they got up and took their books.
Dale was by a lot. That's the only one I've ever seen.
Does Willie know a lot about but the history? He is really into some history stuff, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, I haven't interviewed him yet, but I've talked to him quite a bit.
He knows everybody. I mean, he goes to Florida, and they're all related to him, and he knows everybody. So we hang with Willie and Carolyn a lot.
Well, he's more into Freundschaft than he is into church history particularly. He's into who's related to who.
Yeah.
He's really into that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I interviewed Clifford about 5 months ago. Anyway, a couple months before he died. So.
Just before he died.
Be careful. Don't do anything rash here.
The one I miss is Olin. You know, that, because he's be going strong now yet, you know.
Olin. Yeah, that was...
That was sad.
That was too bad, and that was really a shock, because when I interviewed him, it was just before his court appearance, and so he was upbeat and happy and...
Yeah.
Talk,
I went in there several times.
He knew a lot of history.
Yeah, I felt like I didn't go in there enough to see him, you know. It was quite something, yeah.
Well, I will get out of your hair then. I think you've told me everything you know.
Huh?
Everything printable anyway.
Yeah.
Well,
that's nice what you're doing, you know. We get some history on this.
Well, all of it's going on a website too. Even the interviews will be transposed so that the written data if anybody wants to read them, or they'll be in there in audio.
Uh-huh.
And I go back through and edit them to take out the pauses and, or like Owen was telling some stories that, okay, no, we don't want those in here. just because they weren't necessary, it didn't add anything to it.
They didn't add anything.
Right, exactly. So, interesting to hear, but then they need to...
It's not a history-nistic church.
Yeah, it's been fascinating doing the research on, because the way I'm writing it is that the first part are basically the stories of the individuals who came here up through about 1920, 25 or so. But it's more than just, why they came here, who they were related to that came here, what happened to them after they came and left. Like there are a lot of families, the Barbie family was here for 1 year and gone, you know. Uh-huh. But where'd they come from? What happened? Well, it turns out that the Valley folks would cross into West Virginia to preach. And when it took days on horseback to get there, this wasn't like going to Norfolk and singing at the old folks' home.
Right.
And in one particular valley, they were having meetings there, and this guy walked, 14, 15 miles over to hear him, hear the preacher, and said, "Hey, could you come preach in our valley?" Well, he did, and he converted the Barbie family and another family who built church. Well, one of the Barbie boys started going over to Harrisonburg in the summer to work when he met a girl there. They
migrated to Montana, then Kansas, and then Newport News, and then they were in Fentress for a year. Well, you know, it didn't really add much to the history here, but just telling that story is kind of an illustration of how people came and went and did and what happened to them afterwards. And he went back to Harrisonburg and I guess took over his wife's father's farm, and that's where they lived and died. Mm. So.